Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa. God knows you put your life into its hands, and it's both cradled you and crushed. But now it's time to make your own demands. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, an out-of-the-box think tank about community sovereignty and regenerative economics. We look at how to take back our cities, farmland, and water, our money, production, and trade, our media, education, and culture, our religion, and even our God. We present a people's history of the Bible and a parent's view on how to raise giving kids in a taking world. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Radio Free Brighton, Free Radio Santa Cruz, Upstart Radio Online, and through the Unwelcome Guest Collective. Multimedia transcripts to all shows are available on the website at thirdparadigm.org. Welcome to the 61st episode of Third Paradigm. Over the last few months, as our oldest daughter neared her high school graduation, we've been surprised to realize that college is the ultimate goal of life. After college, it's all downhill. You get a job, get married, rent a house, raise a family, and make it the purpose of your life to get your kids through college. Besides universities being absurdly expensive, I'm not sure that a four-year sleepover with your friends at mom and dad's expense is a healthy thing. It seems like the logical progression should be taking more responsibility for yourself, getting a part-time job, doing your own cooking, cleaning, gardening, and home maintenance, and becoming an asset to your community. Why would we want our daughter to go backwards and have servants in the form of low-wage campus workers? Here in Santa Cruz, we have an excellent two-year college where such a balanced life would be possible. But their funding has been cut so severely that the retiring VP of Business Services has been known to cry in public. Students have to strategize carefully, squeezing into packed classes. Increasingly, only the basics are being taught, making it a university prep school with few extra choices. The wide world of learning for its own sake is being choked off. A popular teacher of sewing, for instance, whose classes always filled on the first day of enrollment, has been laid off, her classes canceled. And so I've been designing an alternative called the Universe City, which includes a gap year curriculum. The gap year is a European tradition of taking a year-long break between high school and university, often to travel and gain life experience. But I'm using it in a different sense, as a rigorous course of study to fill the gaping hole between the reality and worldview promoted by the industrial-military educational complex. Our daughter has done a great job of learning what the test and textbook industry thinks she should know. Now she's ready for a true education. I'm not the only one looking for alternatives to the degree factories. The New York Times just ran an article called "Placing the Blame as Students Are Mired in Debt." It tells the story of Courtney Muna, whose father died when she was 13 and whose mother runs a bed and breakfast. She worked hard to get good grades and was accepted to NYU, where she majored in religion and women's studies. First, she got federal loans and her mother co-signed a loan for $20,000. But when Sallie Mae rejected a third loan, NYU sent them to Citibank, from whom she borrowed another $40,000 over the next 2 years. Finally, NYU said they could get her another $2,000, at which point the mother claims they should have said, "You are in deep doo-doo, little girl." 5 years after graduation, she's $97,000 in debt with no prospect of repayment. With tuition, room, and board, NYU comes to $52,000 a year, or $208,000 for 4 years. Somehow, with grants and work study, Courtney must have managed another $111,000 to get that BA. As an investment, this would be like buying a house with over 50% down. But for Courtney, that remaining 50% has been disastrous. Since her graduation, the most she's made is $22 an hour, which barely pays the rent. Her potential to have a decent life is slim, with the interest mounting and no way out. The article, as the title states, looks for someone to blame. It blames her for majoring in something as non-market-driven as religion or women. It blames her mother for being proud of her daughter and co-signing on the American dream. But it gives Sally Mae a pass on the blame, because after all, they got the mother to sign, who could sell her bread and breakfast to repay. Shrewd business move. The author wonders what Citibank could have been thinking, but concludes that they kept loaning because, if she had to drop out, she'd be less able to repay. Most of the blame, however, the author places on NYU for not counseling students who can't afford it, that they just don't belong there. But then he makes excuses for NYU and the loan counselors, because how would they keep their jobs and stay open if they discourage middle-class students? However, he says, they should require a financial solvency course where the students use their own families as case studies. So who really does belong at NYU? According to the author, children of the wealthy and a much smaller number of low-income students to whom it can afford to give enormous scholarships. The middle class, it implies, should stick with their kind in the state schools. Let's look this dripping elitism in the eye. Even if you're in with the in crowd and can afford $208K without the humiliation of a drawers around the knees show me what you've got finance course, is NYU worth it? If it's not a good investment at half the cost, then it's not worth the money that full boat parents are paying for it. If the major Courtney chose was the problem, then our universities are really upscale trade schools, foregoing learning in order to develop marketable skills. If a young person actually wants to learn, they'd be better off taking unpaid apprenticeships or volunteering while making a meager living on the side. Whatever they learn will be their responsibility, but they can keep it up for the rest of their life without the debt hanging over their head. The reporter, however, could use an education. How can he write an article in the money section of the New York Times without knowing that Citibank and Sally Mae are better off when student loans default? His own paper has run two articles in the last few years entitled "The Student Loan Scam." Doesn't he read his own paper? He could have read Alan Michael Collins' book by that title, which they reviewed and we reviewed in our episode, "The Student Loan Mafia." Blaming the victims while apologizing for the banks, however, is probably better for his career. We'll examine this more when we come back, but first let's hear some poems. This is "When the Shoe Fits" by Chuang Tzu and "Straight Talk from Fox" by Mary Oliver. The music is "A Day Without Rain" and "Tempus Vernum," both by Enya from the CD "A Day Without Rain." When the shoe fits. Chu, the draftsman, could draw more perfect circles freehand than with a compass. His fingers brought forth spontaneous forms from nowhere. His mind was meanwhile free and without concern with what he was doing. No application was needed. His mind was perfectly simple and knew no obstacle. So, when the shoe fits, the foot is forgotten. When the belt fits, the belly is forgotten. When the heart is right, for and against are forgotten. No drives, no compulsions, no needs, no attractions. Then your affairs are under control. You are a free man. Easy is right. Begin right, and you are easy. Continue easy, and you are right. The right way to go easy is to forget the right way and forget that the going is easy. Chuang Tzu, "In the Dark Before Dawn," translated by Thomas Merton. Straight Talk from Fox Listen, says Fox. It is music to run over the hills, to lick dew from the leaves, to nose along the edges of the ponds, to smell the fat ducks in their bright feathers, but far out, safe in their rafts of sleep. It is like music to visit the orchard, to find the vole sucking the sweet of the apple, or the rabbit with his fast-beating heart. Death itself is a music. Nobody has ever come close to writing it down, awake or in a dream. It cannot be told. It is flesh and bones changing shape and with good cause. Mercy is a little child beside such an invention. It is music to wander the black back roads outside of town, no one awake or wondering if anything miraculous is ever going to happen, totally dumb to the fact of every moment's miracle. Don't think I haven't peeked into windows. I see you in all your seasons, making love, arguing, talking about God as if he were an idea, instead of the grass, instead of the stars, the rabbit caught in one good teeth-whacking hit and brought home to the den. What I am, and I know it, is responsible, joyful, thankful. I would not give my life for a thousand of yours. By Mary Oliver from Redbird. That was When the Shoe Fits by Chuang Tzu and Straight Talk from Fox by Mary Oliver. The music was Enya with A Day Without Rain and Tempus Vernum. Before we return to higher education and its discontents, I wanted to correct some conclusions I reached last episode. As I was talking about the lack of critical thinking, I myself fell prey to it. I uncritically reported conclusions the Pew Center had reached from their data on the differences between Democrats and Republicans on a survey of happiness. They found that Republicans are more content with what they have, less interested in wealth, free time, and career growth, and more interested in marriage, family, and religion. But when I looked at the chart from another angle, at the degree to which Republicans and Democrats agreed, 55% of both felt a successful career was important, and 63% valued free time, but 83% said wealth didn't matter to them. These majority positions of both parties are much more significant than the few percentage points they differ by. It's true that marriage and religion are significantly more important to Republicans, but 56% agree that having children is important, and 55% of both value charity work. So even though Democrats don't have as high a regard for the institutions of marriage and religion, they prioritize raising a family and helping others, just like the Republicans. When I looked at the data this way, it seems obvious that we agree on far, far more than where we disagree. How could the Pew Center have focused only on the fractional margins of difference rather than the whole? It makes me wonder which right-wing think tank is paying their bills. Maybe the same one that's been grooming a light-skinned, articulate, and compliant black man for president. Speaking of which, we also talked about Obama in the last episode and why he talks like a Democrat but marches in lockstep with the Republicans. My optimistic neighbors have hope that he's laying the bipartisan groundwork to introduce the changes we were all salivating for. My own view is more cynical, recalling John Perkins' talks on his book Confessions of an Economic Hitman. In them, Perkins reveals how he was carefully selected, not for his strengths, but for his weaknesses. In his case, women and a sense of inferiority to the wealthy kids he went to school with. The mentor he was assigned was a dominant and sexy woman who alternated flattery and rejection, enticement and withdrawal. He was hooked and reeled in, establishing a pattern by which they could manipulate him. If this is done with economic hitmen, Could it be possible that any politician gets the nod without having been selected at a malleable age and groomed for obedience? What would Obama's weaknesses be? He was also a poor kid going to school with rich kids, and being black among whites must have left a chink in the playground armor. But the most significant factor, I think, is his absent dad. If the right father figure came along, taking young Barack under his wing and introducing him to the right people, it's easy to see how he could identify with that authority figure. Obama's compliance seems too smooth to be forced. He seems to believe what he's saying, even though it's the opposite of what he said before. I'd bet money that somewhere there's a well-oiled patrician coaching and praising him and being quietly but firmly disappointed in him when he doesn't measure up. We might as well save our breath. No well-reasoned argument is going to change his mind if he spent the last decade in obedience school. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll look at an article about the higher education bubble, and we'll examine Anya Kamenetz's book, DIYU, about edupunks, edupreneurs, and the coming transformation of higher education. But first, let's hear a song. This is Same Old by Chumbawamba. Welcome back to Third Paradigm, thirdparadigm.org. That was Same Old by Chumbawamba from their CD, The Boy Bands Win Again. We're now going to look at a Washington Examiner article by Glenn Reynolds called Higher Education's Bubble is About to Burst. It compares college to the housing market for the return on investment. Like California real estate, the cost of a new four-year degree has gone up over 400% in one generation. Unlike California real estate, that doesn't mean you can sell the one you already bought for four times as much. In both, as the product becomes more expensive, cheap credit encourages higher debt. It becomes normalized, as what everyone does. Parents and students see it as their only ticket to prosperity, no matter what the cost, and so they sign on. But according to Reynolds, the bubble is ready to burst. Student loan demand is going soft. Jobs for new grads are looking wobbly. Websites are springing up with titles like The Great College Hoax. The once shimmering horizon is starting to look more like an oil slick in which sea turtles are burning. As a law professor, Reynolds wonders if academic institutions will survive the implosion, or whether new ways of teaching and learning will come out of left field. He cites Anya Kamenetz and the edupunks and places his bets on the latter. After reading DIYU myself, I tend to agree. Let's see why. The first part of the book researches the history, sociology, and economics of how we got here, starting with statistics. 9 out of 10 high school seniors say they want to go to college. 34% expect to get a bachelor's, and 35% want to go to graduate school. Higher education is the closest thing we have, Kamenetz claims, to a world religion. In 1900, 500,000 people worldwide went to college. A century later, it was 100 million people. A mere decade later, it's risen to 150 million. But here in the U.S., where there's a will, there's no apparent way. 3 out of 10 students drop out of high school. Of those who start a four-year college, only 53% will graduate within 5 years. resulting in only 36% of all high school students ending up with a four-year degree. On Democracy Now!'s 4th of July special, Michael Moore talked about being in the other 64% with just a high school diploma. It doesn't seem to have hurt him. High school counselors often quote the million-dollar premium that a college degree adds to your lifetime salary. But as the cost of an education has gone up, the wage premium for a college degree has stayed flat since the turn of the millennium. While degreed incomes have plateaued, however, non-college incomes have declined sharply. So the payoff's the same at the higher ante, but the fear of losing everything keeps us in the high-stakes game. Apropos of Michael Moore, Comet reports on teenagers forced into college by the closing of GM. Before, high school students had the option of a union job and a good life, like their parents. But now they have to compete for increasingly scarce white-collar jobs. Stanford sociologist Mitchell Stevens writes, "College was about improving your circumstances. It wasn't a baseline for survival. What does it mean if college is the only avenue to a decent living in this century? That's the conversation we're not having nationally." In 1987, Mark Blogg took a jaundiced look at college in The Economics of Education and the Education of an Economist. He found it impossible to single out the effects of an education. Better educated people, he writes, have better educated parents, come from smaller homes, obtain financial help more easily, live in cities, are better motivated, achieve higher scores in intelligence and aptitude tests, attain better academic grade records, gain more from self-education, and generally live longer and are healthier. They earn more simply because they've had all the advantages in life, of which more education is only one, and not even the most important one. I tried to explain this to my mother the other day, while she tried to convince me I was dooming my daughter Veronica to a Walmart job by not sending her straight off to college. She quoted the statistics that college graduates earn more. I asked her how many students had been compared who had the grades, motivation, and money to go to college, but chose to do something else out of principle. Maybe because it's not available to everyone, or because it's destroying other young people through debt and the military. Like the prior example from the Pew Research Center, you can start with the same set of data and get a completely different answer, depending on how you phrase the question. What if parents who had the money to send their kids to college chose to have them earn it instead by teaching themselves? They could learn in peer group settings, from the information abundantly available in books, on the web, in videos and audio files. Even better, what if they first learned what their parents had to teach, or their neighbors, or community groups in their town? Everywhere you turn, there are people with passions on any given subject. Give the scarecrow or the tin woodsman a diploma tied with a ribbon, and you'll find he's as clever as any professor. To do a true comparison of the investment value of a degree, you'd first have to find motivated students who would put the same amount of time and effort into learning for 4 to 5 years without an institution hanging over their heads. And then you need to equalize the money. To compare apples to apples, academically speaking, we have to see how the self-educated student would do if, at the end, they could use the money they didn't spend on college for a down payment on a house. Maybe their income wouldn't be the measure we use for success, but the freedom to pursue a good life that neither serves other people's interest nor requires that other people serve theirs. While Wall Street and the government might not hire them, they'd have the self-discipline to work for themselves. And even better for our democracy, they'd be able to think for themselves. For Third Paradigm, this has been Teresa Caraggio. Thank you to Robin Maycomer of Digital Media, who's helped me to learn how to do this, the first of my own sound productions and editing. Thanks to Skidmark Bob, who'll still be contributing music and moral support, I hope. Thank you, as always, to Mike Sirocco, who enables me to not learn how to do web editing and still have a stunning and multifunctional website. We end the show with Brett Denon's Someday. Brett is a product of our own excellent but too expensive university, UCSE. His hope for the great escape is shared by his whole generation. Thanks for listening.
Yeah. In the womb of winter, summer seems a myth. In my desperation, I throw my faith into the wind. Born to a world where it is a fight just to fit in. From the cradle to the grave, it never ends. Someday, someday, in a cloud of gray, I will, I may, my great escape. There's so many ways to walk upon the earth. I chase my footsteps to the place of my birth. So why do you deal with all your precious time? So many ways in which to reach for the sky. Someday, someday, in a cloud of gray, I will, I may my great escape. Someday, someday, in a cloud of gray, I will, I'll make my great escape. Yeah. Of grace.